Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Maryland lawmakers who start their 2017 General Assembly session at noon today face a range of environmental decisions, from fracking to trading credits for pollution, from tax credits for electric cars to cleaning up the bay. Tim Wheeler, managing editor and project writer for the Chesapeake Bay Journal, joins us with a preview of the session's anticipated environmental agenda. The Bay Journal is a monthly print and online publication about issues and events that affect the Chesapeake Bay. Welcome back, Tim.
Good to be here, Sheila.
Let's start with fracking. The controversial method of extracting natural gas by forcing water, sand, and chemicals into the ground. In 2015, legislators agreed to a temporary moratorium on fracking. That's set to expire this coming October. And this past fall, Maryland Secretary of the Environment unveiled regulations that Governor Hogan would like to use to put fracking in place. Western Maryland sits above the Marcellus Shale, a stretch of rock containing untapped natural gas reserves. Do I have the right impression that these proposed regulations are pretty strict?
Well, they've certainly sold them as strict. You'll remember that former Governor O'Malley proposed some regulations, and he called them the gold standard. Now, the Hogan administration is calling theirs the platinum standard. They made some of the provisions in there. They added some things, made them a little stricter. They also rolled back a few things. Setbacks are not quite as great, and air monitoring is not quite as strict either.
When you say setbacks are not as great.
Well, how far the well pad has to be from like a stream or a house. And this is a sort of a ever-changing landscape. I mean, there are other states that have had to deal with this, and over time they have made their regulations stricter. So it's not quite as simple as it seems.
Well, at the end of December, leaders of the Administrative, Executive, and Legislative Review Committee asked Environmental Secretary Ben Grumbles for more time to consider the proposed regulations. How does that play into what the legislature may do with the moratorium?
The AELR committee, to use its acronym, has the authority to hold up, but they can't stop regulations. They can slow them down, and that's essentially what they've done here, is to slow them down, delay their effectiveness. The members raised a number of points, things they were concerned about, things that they thought were missing or too weak in the regulations. They thought that the penalties, which were, I think, $50,000 penalty, was not very large for oil and gas companies making millions. And there were other concerns that they asked them to look at. Ben Grumbles, the environment secretary, said he would look at them. But to make many changes, they would have to go back and repropose them. This gives a window. The regulations can't take effect until, I think, the end of February now, even if the department wanted to go ahead and force them through. So there's a window for the legislature to weigh in. Obviously, the General Assembly goes until April, so they may not actually decide something by then. In either case, what the General Assembly did in 2015 was say no regulation can take effect until October 1 of this year. So they have a chance through legislation to impact those regulations. They can legislate restrictions. They can they could adopt a ban or even an extended moratorium. There's some sentiment for both. The environmental groups are pushing very hard to get a permanent ban or at least a very long-term moratorium. There may be some legislators who feel like they want to take more time to look at this some more.
And so the most the legislature could do on that side would be to extend the moratorium.
Well, I think they could legislate restrictions as well. I mean, they can do through legislation what regulation might do in a number of cases. They could direct regulations to do certain things.
You have a piece out now in the Bay Journal about the funding issues affecting states that surround the Bay. Maryland faces a $400 million budget gap this year, another $400 million the next year. How is this shortfall likely to affect what the state can accomplish on the environment?
You know, it's never easy when you have less money to do as much. And so that will be one of the big questions. There are areas in environmental programs now that have been reduced over time. The staffing, there's concerns about the level of inspections that have been occurring. And so if there are cuts, the question is, are they going to cut from environmental programs, they're going to cut across the board? Where would those cuts happen? And, you know, money actually makes a difference.
Those money questions usually aren't settled until the closing days of the session in April.
That's exactly right.
Last week, Governor Larry Hogan announced a package of environmental proposals totaling $65 million. It includes training for careers in solar, wind, hydroelectric, and other green industries, a Green Energy Institute at the University of Maryland, and tax credits to promote the use of electric vehicles. From your looking at this package, what's the most important, and what is most likely to pass the legislature?
Well, I can't see that the legislature would oppose the spending. Obviously, this is a chunk of money that is actually new money in a way, or at least it's money that's been held in reserve. This is a pot of money. At least $44 million of that comes from the settlement that was reached in the Exelon-BGE Constellation merger. In order to get that approved, the company agreed to set $44 million aside to promote renewable energy in one way, shape, or form. That money has not been spent up until now, and he's obviously tapping into that. So, I mean, there might be some quibbling about whether that's the right way to spend it. The other piece of that, there's a $10 million chunk that's supposed to go to jumpstart, if you will, a program that has been struggling to get off the ground involving pollution trading. This one has direct impact on the Chesapeake Bay.
Is there a quick way to describe pollution trading?
What that is? Well, in essence, if you or I had to take care of the runoff at our house, it could cost us a lot of money. But maybe we could pay our neighbor to do something that would cost less. And therefore, we pay him or her to clean up the pollution on their property, and then we take credit for it.
And there's some way of measuring the pollution to say that the substituted action has as much impact on the environment as the original action would have had?
Well, that's where it gets a little tricky, because it's easy to measure pollution coming out of a pipe. It's harder to measure pollution when it's running off of your property in rainfall. The easy way that these pollution trades have happened, and there have been some trading going on in Pennsylvania and Virginia, and there's a few trading programs around the country. Typically, the easy way to do that is if you have pollution coming out of a pipe, a wastewater treatment plant, and a factory or something like that, they can actually measure what they're doing, and it's easy to account for it. When you're talking about paying a farmer to cut down on runoff from his farm, it's more challenging because it's harder to measure. Now, there are studies. They use, you know, basically, you know, sort of yardsticks of what they expect to happen in a typical farm. And then the question is, are they actually going back and inspecting and making sure these things get done and that they last? Those are the tests. And part of the reason why this program has been so long in getting off the ground is because of all these sort of moving parts, all this these challenges. And the farmers themselves have been a little bit reluctant to get involved because they have felt so much pressure to clean up their act that they're not quite sure whether they're going to get themselves stuck or in trouble if they get involved in a program like this.
Because the funding that the governor is proposing, $10 million you mentioned, is money that environmentalists had expected to be spent on upgrading sewage treatment, correct?
Exactly. The fund that he's using here, this again is not new money. He's shifting money from another fund called the Bay Restoration Fund. It's what you and I call or used to call the flush fee or the flush tax. You pay a fee on your utility bill or in your property tax if you're in a septic system to basically help clean up the bay. And the money goes to pay for upgrades of wastewater treatment plants. And it's financed the upgrades of most of the very large treatment plants in the state. There's still a lot of medium and small treatment plants that have not been upgraded. There's a fair amount of money in this pot. It's about $60 million. He's proposing to take 10. But what he's proposing to do with that is they're going to use that $10 million. The state is going to buy credits and then distribute them around. They think that if they start demonstrating how this trading program works, that then other people, private entities, will get into it, spend their own money in order to buy credits that they can sell to somebody else, and that this thing will get off the ground. The idea is that it would not be done through regulation, but through the market, that you could make money reducing pollution.
But this would require legislative action. This is not something the governor could do on his own.
Exactly. That would. And there's going to be a lot of questions about it.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Tim Wheeler, managing editor of the Bay Journal, about the environmental issues up for consideration during this year's legislative session. You have been following the efforts by Maryland and Virginia to restore oyster populations and habitat in Chesapeake tributaries with the help of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Give us a short update.
There is a commitment by both states through the Chesapeake Bay Agreement that was signed in 2014 to do large-scale oyster restoration projects in five tributaries each, 10 in all. Maryland has identified three of those five, and they've actually completed work in one, Harris Creek, a tributary of the Choptank River on the eastern shore. Work is underway, partially done, in two others, the Little Choptank River and the Tredavon River. They've not been without controversy. You would think everybody loves oysters and everybody wants to have more. But a lot of it has to do with the methods. To explain how this works is these tributaries have some oysters, but not very many. The idea is to build new reefs because a lot of the oyster reefs have disappeared. They've worn down, been buried in mud. So they come in and they build new reefs, and then they put hatchery-spawned juvenile baby oysters on the reefs, let them grow up. The thought is that they will then reproduce and they will become, hopefully, self-sustaining one day. That's still to be proven. But in doing that, they didn't have enough shell. Oyster shells are typically what baby oysters like to settle on. So they had to use other materials. They used granite rocks, and they used clam shells, and they used some fossil shell material dredged out of a quarry in Florida. Watermen in particular did not like the use of the rocks and the fossil shell. They felt that they were affecting water quality. They thought the rocks hinder their ability to crab. They catch their trot lines on them and that sort of thing. And some of the reefs that were built in Harris Creek with the rocks were actually built a little higher than they should have been, and so they became navigation hazards. Some boats were damaged. They ran aground on them. So there had been controversy over this. The watermen convinced the Hogan administration to put the Tredavon work on hold last year about this time, and it was held up until just this winter. The Maryland DNR decided in the end, Department of Natural Resources, that there was evidence that the oysters that were being put in there were surviving and growing, and they were actually doing some better than the ones that were not in sanctuaries. So the program has gone forward, but there's still this debate and tension over the materials used. The problem is that there aren't enough oyster shells to really increase the population of oysters.
Is there also a debate over whether watermen should be able to be harvesting these oysters?
Yes, that's the other side of this. The state under former Governor O'Malley decided that one thing that the Bay needed was more oysters for ecological reasons and not for harvest, not for eating. And so they expanded the state's network of sanctuaries in a large way. They cover about 25% of the Bay now. And the watermen were opposed to that. They said, you're taking money out of our pockets by doing that. So they objected at the time. It went forward anyway with the Hogan administration. They have come back in and said, we would like to get access to some of those sanctuaries. Their argument, to some degree, is that a number of the sanctuaries, there's been no work done in them. The oysters, there are not that many oysters there anyway. We will put in some shell of our own. We will put in some seed oysters that we pay for using government money, for the most part, or money that they paid through taxes. And we will harvest those on a regulated basis. They proposed getting access to about 14,000 acres worth of sanctuaries. Within that, there are about 3,000 acres worth of oyster reefs. The department is still talking about that. There is some motion on the other side. Environmental groups want a trade-off. And so they're expected to come forward with some proposals for expanding other sanctuaries to make up for these.
This will all be decided by Governor Hogan's administration, or does the legislature get into this?
You know, the legislature could get into it in the end because they adopted the laws that created the sanctuary system and made it easier to lease the bottom for private oyster farming. Right now, the department is still working its way through this process with an advisory commission, and it may not be until after the legislature is done that they'll actually make a decision.
I appreciate you giving us this overview. Thank you.
Sure.
Tim Wheeler is managing editor and project writer for the Bay Journal. We will link to the stories mentioned at the On the Record page, WIPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break now. When we come back, a second chance for Baltimore residents with outstanding warrants. Stay with us.